We present episode one of That Hideous Strength.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about it?
No.
Good girl. You'll soon be all right.
Yes. Are you going into college, Mark?
Yes. It's the big meeting today. I might be rather late. Jane?
Yes, I heard you.
Sorry. Perhaps you should try and get some more sleep.
No.
Look, I don't like to see you like this. Is there something I can do?
No, it doesn't matter. Please, Mark. Go to the meeting.
I'll be home as soon as I can. I promise.
Though I am Oxford-bred and am very fond of Cambridge, I think that Edgestowe is more beautiful than either. For one thing, it is so small. No maker of cars or sausages or marmalades has yet come to industrialise the town, and the university itself is tiny. Apart from Bracton College and a women's college beyond the railway, there are only two others, Northumberland and Duke's. This fine morning, as Mark, who is a fellow of Bracton, walks down to his college, he does not, alas, notice the morning beauty of the little hillside suburb where he lives, nor the gentle charm of the town itself. He is thinking of a very different matter.
Ah, Stoddock!
Oh, hello, Curry.
Oh, I'm glad I've run into you. Are you heading for the meeting?
Yes.
It'll take the hell of a time. Probably go on after dinner. Have you seen the agenda?
Yes. I was just puzzling over that item, sale of college property.
Ah, yes. Sale of the area marked pink on the attached map. Yes, indeed.
Which is Bragdon Wood.
Yes.
Rather contentious, wouldn't you say, Curry?
Ah, well, it may be. But if the National Institute for Coordinated Experiments is to come here at all, that's the only place on which they'll consider building.
Do you think it'll go through, then?
Sure to. We've got the warden, the bursar, all the chemical and biochemical people for a start. Oh, and I should have told you, Dick's going to be there.
Telford?
Telford? No! I mean Lord Feversley. Dick Devine, as he used to be.
I was a little baffled by the idea of Telford. I'm glad Feverson is coming. I've never met him.
Oh, you must, Stoddock. Come and have drinks in my rooms tonight. I'll ask him.
Yeah, I should like to very much. By the way, I suppose Feverson's position is quite secure.
How do you mean?
Well, there was some talk, if you remember, as to whether someone who was away quite so much could go on holding a fellowship.
But didn't you think that absolute blah?
Well, as between ourselves, yes. But I must confess, Curry, that if I were put up to explain why a man who is nearly always in London should go on being a fellow of Bracton, I shouldn't find it altogether easy.
There's one thing that perhaps you ought to know about Dick Feverson, Stoddock.
What's that?
He got you your fellowship. Oh, yes. Denison was your chief rival. Between ourselves, many people liked his papers better than yours. It was Dick who insisted you were the sort of man we really wanted. He took the line that the one thing to consider is the type of man we need, and be damned to paper qualifications. And I must say he turned out to be right.
Very kind of you.
But be sure you're in the meeting when the sale of Bragdon Wood item comes up. We may need your voice.
Oh, I'll be there.
The only time I was a guest at Bracton, I persuaded my host to let me into the wood and leave me alone there for an hour. He apologized for locking me in. Very few people were allowed into Bracton Wood. I suppose the mere fact of its being walled in gave the wood its peculiar quality. For when a thing is enclosed, the mind does not willingly regard it as common. I was quite alone in there, and it felt like the loneliness of a very large room in a deserted house. I remember thinking, this is the sort of place which, as a child, one would have been rather afraid of, or else would have liked very much indeed. In half a mile, I came to the center of the wood, and there was the thing I had come to see. It was a well. A well with steps going down to it, and the remains of an ancient pavement about it. A well known for centuries as Merlin's Well. I lay down in the grass and touched it with my fingers, for this was the heart of Bragdon Wood. Out of this, all the legends had come. Legends that Merlin lay beneath, buried though not dead, awaiting resurrection. And inspired by this, a 14th century song.
In Bragdon bright, this ender day, hair dye Merlin there he lay, singing and a woe and well away.
Bragdon Wood is a place of shadows and mild sunshine, contemplation, mystery, cooing birds, running water, and quiet turf. And it is the place that marks peers, the progressive element among the fellows of Bracton College, are intending should be sold off and bulldozed to give place to a building that would make a quite noticeable addition to the skyline of New York.
Oh, here she is.
Hello, Jane.
Hello.
How nice of you to come, dear.
Oh, well, it was kind of you to invite me. I'm sure I'd have skipped lunch otherwise. How lovely your garden's looking, Dr. Bimble.
You'd better take a good look at it, then.
Oh, what do you mean?
Haven't you told her, dear?
I haven't screwed myself up to it yet. Besides, poor dear, her husband is one of the villains of the piece.
Ah.
Anyway, I expect she knows.
I've no idea what you're talking about.
Your husband's college is being so tiresome, dear. They're turning us out. They won't renew the lease.
Mrs. Dimble, I didn't even know this was Bracton College property.
There you are. One half of the world doesn't know how the other half lives. Here have I been imagining that you were using all your influence over Mr. Studdett to try to save us, whereas in reality...
Mark never talks to me about college business.
Good husbands never do.
At least only about the business of other people's colleges.
That's why I know all about Bracton College and nothing about Northumberland.
Anyone coming in to lunch?
You go on in, dear. Jane, you're not entirely looking yourself. There's nothing wrong, is there?
Wrong? Why? What should there be?
Do you hate being kissed?
Thus, Mrs. Dimble, in her fine, intuitive way, gently puts her finger on the troublesome spot. For having only recently been married, Jane is still astonished at the difference between her hopes for marriage and its realization.
Marriage was ordained,
she quotes bitterly,
for the mutual society, help and comfort that the one ought to have of the other. But I feel I'm in something like solitary confinement since we married.
Oh, my dear.
I'm endlessly alone. And it's so predictable that the phone will ring in the late afternoon and it'll be Mark to tell me he has to work late and he'll be dining in college. Sometimes I wonder why he married me.
Oh, but Mark's still in love with you, isn't he, dear?
Oh, I don't know. If he is, then being in love must mean something totally different to men and women. I mean, look at John Donne. Hope not for mind in women at their best sweetness and wit.
They are but mummy possessed.
Mrs. Dimble,
Do any men really want mind in women? I don't think Mark does.
Let's go and have lunch.
And has it ever struck you what an odd creation Merlin is?
Hmm.
He's not evil, yet he's a magician. He's obviously a druid, yet he knows all about the Grail. He's the devil's son. But we're told that the kind of being who fathered him was not necessarily bad.
Well, whether he's good or bad, he's safely buried under Bragdon Wood.
Buried, though not dead.
Oh.
And that's an odd thing. Why should the NICE be so determined to have Bragdon Wood as the base of their headquarters? I can't imagine a little cockney like their director Jules being influenced by any poetic fancy about Merlin. I wonder what they'll find when they start digging there.
First mud and then water.
Yes, I dare say some of the NICE people would like to find Merlin. Though whether they'd be equipped to cope with him, I rather doubt.
That child's going to faint.
Jane, what's the matter?
Oh, it's too ridiculous. It's just that I had a rather odd dream last night.
Yes?
And for some reason your conversation is reminding me.
Jane, tell us about it.
Yes, do.
Well, there was a foreign-looking face, bearded and rather yellow, with a hooked nose. Its expression was frightened. The mouth sagged open and the eyes stared as if it had had some shock.
Horrible.
You poor dear thing.
Then I saw it was a man who was sitting hunched up in one corner of a little square room with whitewashed walls, waiting. Then the door opened and a rather good-looking man with a pointed grey beard came in. They spoke in French. I could only make out some of what they said. The visitor was telling the prisoner something which he intended him to regard as good news.
Hmm.
As he did, the prisoner grew more and more distressed until he became utterly terrified.
Go on.
Well, all of that seemed real. Not like a dream at all. But then it did become much more like a nightmare. The visitor adjusted his pince-nez, smiled very coldly, seized the prisoner's head, gave it a sharp turn, and unscrewed it.
Oh.
Just like a diver's helmet.
Oh, horrible, dear. How upsetting for you.
Oh, I am sorry. This really isn't the sort of subject for lunchtime, is it?
But please, go on. It's fascinating.
Well, he took the head away, and it sort of changed then into a head with a reddish-white beard, all covered with earth. It belonged to an old man whom some people were digging up in a kind of churchyard. He looked like an old druid or something. And at first I thought it was a corpse, but then I saw it was coming to life. And I yelled out, "Look out, he's alive! Stop, stop, you're waking him!" But they didn't stop. And he sat up and started talking in some weird ancient language.
Did it sound vaguely like Spanish, by any chance?
I thought it was Spanish. Cecil?
Oh, just a possibility of something.
Do you have a paper?
But today's paper, Jane? Unless Cecil cleans his pipe out on it.
It's here. Look.
Ah.
Why?
Do you see the article about a man being executed in France?
Oh, yes. Execution of Alcathan. Scientist Bluebeard goes to guillotine.
You see the photograph? Foreign-looking with a hooked nose?
Yes.
That was a man in my dream.
I see. So you'd seen the paper. And did it disturb you?
No, Mrs. Timble. I dreamt it before I saw the paper.
Well, you'd followed the story, perhaps.
Yes.
To my knowledge, I hadn't heard of the business at all.
Congratulations, one and all.
Oh, we certainly pulled that off all right. Well done, Dick.
Thank you, Busby. Thank you, Curry. Well done, one and all. Even Studdock here played his part.
Well,
aren't you? Yes, you did. And so the NIC is to come to Edgestone.
Yes.
It really does mark the start of something massive. Open that bottle, would you, Studdock?
Right.
You know, I think we must take the credit, in a small way, for having the foresight and seeing off all those wretched diehards and obstructionists.
Of course.
It was very impressive, Curry. I even felt quite sorry for old Canon Jewel when Lord Feverston put him in his place.
Yeah. Oh, what was it you said, Dick? As he stood there bumbling on?
I said if Canon Jewel wishes us not to hear his views, I suggested his end could be better attained by silence.
And you wouldn't feel sorry for old Jewel if you knew what he was like in his prime.
Oh, brother. Quite right, Busby. Besides, I take the Clausewitz view. Total war is the most humane in the long run. I shut him up instantaneously. Good health, all.
To the National Institute for Coordinated Experiments.
The NICE.
The NICE. May it flourish and triumph.
Yeah.
And the sooner the better. Then I can stop having to deal with all these obstructionists and get on with my job. Well done, Dick.
Your job being?
Well, my book.
Oh, yes, the book, yes.
Well, I can well see Curry might feel that way. Supposing he resigned his office as sub-warden and retired into his cave, he might give us a thunderingly good book on economics.
Economics?
I happen to be a military historian.
I mean military history, of course. He might give us a thunderingly good book on military history. But it will be superseded in 20 years, whereas the work he's doing now, the business of bringing the NIC to Edgestone, that will benefit the town for centuries.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not merely thinking of the financial side of it, though as bursar I rate that pretty high, but think of the new life, the awakening of new vision, the stirring of dormant impulses. What would any book on economics
military
be compared with a thing like that? I look upon it as the greatest triumph of practical idealism that this century has yet seen.
That's rather the sort of thing one hoped. I mightn't put it exactly as you do, Busby. Oh.
Yeah, think how put out Cambridge will be. They were desperate to get the Institute to go there.
Has anyone discovered what, precisely, the NICE is? Or what it intends to do?
Well, that comes oddly from you, Dick. I thought you were in on it yourself.
Ah. Now, isn't it just a little naive to suppose that being in on a thing involves any distinct knowledge of its official program?
Well, I mean, if you mean details.
Surely, Featherstone, you're making a great mystery about nothing. I should have thought the object of the NICE were pretty clear. It's the first attempt to take applied science seriously from the national point of view. It's going to mobilize all the talent of the country, and not only the scientific talent in the narrower sense. Its own police, I'm told. Its own permanent staff of architects, surveyors, engineers, all the things stupendous.
Careers for our sons, I see.
Yeah? What do you mean by that, Lord Field?
Oh, God, what a brick to drop. I had quite forgotten you had a family, possibly.
For me, the NICE marks the beginning of a new era. The really scientific era. Well, up to now, everything has been haphazard. This is going to put science on a scientific basis. There are to be 40 interlocking committees sitting every day, and they've got a wonderful gadget. I was shown the model last time I was in town, by which the findings of each committee print themselves off in their own little compartment on the analytical notice board every half hour. A glance at the board shows you the policy of the whole institute actually taking shape under your own eyes. Marvellous. They call it a pragmatometer.
Oh, pragmatometer is going to be the big thing. Hundreds of people are going in for it.
What do you think about it, Studdock?
Well, I think that Busby touched on the most important point when he said it would have its own legal staff and its own police. At last we're going to get science applied to social problems and backed by the whole force of the state. Just as war has been backed by the whole force of the state in the past.
Come.
Excuse me, Mr. Curry, the warden would like to see you.
Oh, damn. Look, help yourselves to drinks. Hopefully I won't be long.
I must get off myself. I'm going to bed early. I've been on my legs nearly all day.
Good idea.
A man's a fool to hold any office in this college. Curry, my lad, you'd have had an easier life if you'd stuck to economics.
Pragmatometers. Practical idealism. Do you know, it really is rather devastating that the people one has to use for getting things done should talk such drivel the moment you ask them about the things themselves.
And yet they are, in a sense, the brains of Bracknell.
Good Lord, no! Busby and Curry can be persuaded to take the right train, even to drive it, but they haven't got a ghost of a notion where it's going to. Or why. They will sweat blood to bring the NICE to Edgestone. That's why they're indispensable. But what the point of the NICE is? Well, what the point of anything is? Oh, ask them another.
Pragmatometry.
Perhaps I'm in the same boat myself.
Oh, not at all. You saw the point at once. I knew you would. I have read everything you've written since you were in for your fellowship. Oh. That's what I wanted to talk to you about. More wine?
Oh, thank you.
I want you to come into the Institute.
You mean to leave Bracknell?
Oh, that makes no odds. It sounds rather in Busby's style to say that humanity is at the crossroads. But it is the main question at the moment. If science is really given a free hand, it can now take over the human race and recondition it, take control of our own destiny. Make man a really efficient animal. If it doesn't, well, we're done.
Go on.
Oh, it's serious, Stoddick. You will hear people like Carrie or Busby going on about the war against reaction, but it never enters their heads that it might be a real war with real casualties. Do you remember Weston?
He was killed in a blitz, wasn't he?
He was murdered.
Murdered?
The murderer is the respectable Cambridge Don. With weak eyes and a fair beard. He has dined in this college.
Why was Weston murdered?
For being on our side. Their side will stop at nothing. They are going to fight every inch of the way.
They can't win.
Well, we'll hope not. But look, come out to Belbury tomorrow.
Belbury?
Where we've got our headquarters at the moment. Ah. Meet John Wither, our deputy director. He told me to bring you for the weekend, if you were interested. You'll meet all the important people there. It'll give you a chance to make up your mind. I could call and pick you up.
Thanks very much.
Hello?
Mrs. Dimble?
Speaking.
It's Jane.
Oh, Jane. Hello, dear. Jane?
Yes. I'm sorry to ring you so late.
That's quite all right.
It's just that I've been on my own all evening, and I'm afraid I've... Well, I've been imagining things to do with my dreams and things.
Oh, dear.
Yes. And I've been thinking. You remember you suggested someone I might see about it?
Yes.
Well, I think I would like to, if you wouldn't mind.
One moment.
Yes?
Her name is Miss Ironwood, and she lives out at St. Anne's on the Hill.
Well, should I make an appointment?
No, they'll be... You needn't make an appointment. Good night now.
Good night. What did she mean, they'll be... They'll be expecting you. Oh, Mark!
Jane, I'm sorry I'm so late. Really, I am.
Oh, Mark, I've been so frightened.
What? Oh, not another of these dreams, is it?
I kept seeing a sort of image of this very tall woman dressed in black, very strong-looking. I don't know who she was.
It's all right. It'll be all right.
Tea?
Oh. Jane, thank you. Do you feel all right this morning?
Yes, thank you.
You're quite sure?
Quite.
You know, if you feel the least bit uncomfortable, I could put off going to see this man with her. If I do go, I'll certainly have to be away for the night. Perhaps two.
That's perfectly all right. I'm quite accustomed to being alone.
That's the devil of the way things are in college at present. That's one of the chief reasons I'm thinking of another job. Look here, old thing. I don't feel comfortable about going away while you're in your present state.
What state?
Well, I mean, just a bit nervy.
As anyone might be temporarily.
Because I happened to have had nightmares yesterday and was upset when he came home last night. Or rather, this morning. There's no need to talk as if I were a neurasthenic.
Now, there's no good going on like that.
But what? If you've decided that I'm going mad, you'd better get Briseager to come down and certify me. They could get me packed off while you're at Mr. Withers without any fuss. I'm going to see about the breakfast now. If you don't shave and dress pretty quickly, I'll not be ready for Lord Feverston when he calls.
An observer placed at the right altitude above Edgestowe later that morning might have seen, far to the south, a moving spot on a main road, and to the east, and much more slowly moving, the smoke of a train. This train would have been that in which Jane Studdock was progressing slowly to the village of St. Anne's, while the moving spot was the car which was carrying Mark Studdock towards the blood transfusion office at Belbury, where the nucleus of the NICE had its temporary abode. The very size and style of the car makes a favourable impression on Mark the moment he sees it. And what fine male energy, Mark feels sick of women at the moment, reveals itself in the very gestures with which Feverston settles himself at the wheel and puts his elbow on the horn and clasps his pipe firmly between his teeth.
Have you noticed, Studdock, how as soon as one drives at a reasonable speed, one seems to collect every half-witted octogenarian in Edgestowe in front of one? Out of the way, you imbecile!
That was totally his fault.
Of course. You drive much as well?
Used to.
Dog was damn lucky. I am very glad you're coming, by the way.
So am I.
It's of immense importance just now to be on the right side. If you try to be neutral, you simply become a pawn.
Oh, I haven't any doubt which is my side.
Good.
Hang it all. The preservation of the human race, it's a pretty rock bottom obligation.
Yeah, well, you must remember that the other side would claim to be preserving humanity too. The practical point is that you and I don't like being pawns. And we do rather like fighting, especially on the winning side, eh?
Then what is the first practical step?
That's the real question, and of course there are various. There is the problem of our rivals on this planet. I don't mean only insects and bacteria. There's far too much life of every kind about, animal and vegetable. We haven't really cleared the place yet. Got it! Oh, yes! And we still haven't short-circuited the question of the balance of nature. All that is to be gone into. And then, of course, there's man himself.
Go on, this interests me very much.
Man has got to take charge of man. Which means that some men have to take charge of the rest. You and I want to be the people who do the taking charge, not the ones who are taken charge of.
What sort of thing did you have in mind?
Well, we'll take this village. Oh, picturesque, certainly, but a clear anachronism, unproductive and insanitary.
Well, it's a beauty spot.
It may be. You take a look sometime at its population. You'll find it consists almost entirely of the two most undesirable elements. Small rentiers and agricultural labourers.
Well, the small rentier is a bad element, I agree.
Right.
I suppose the agricultural labourer is more controversial.
The Institute doesn't approve of him. He is a very recalcitrant element in a planned community. And he is always backward.
Mm.
Luckily enough, though, these villages are in a valley. The idea is to dam it at the southern end and make the whole thing a reservoir.
Mm.
We'll need a new water supply now that Edgestowe's to be the second city in the country.
What about the living unit?
Oh, living units. I like the way you sociologists speak. The living units will be relocated in a new model village. 4 miles away, on the railway line.
Good. I'm in favour. An efficient placement of the human resource.
The real thing at last. A whole new population housed where we can keep a clear eye on it, in properly ventilated dwellings. And it's people like you who have got to start the ball rolling.
Don't think it's false modesty, but I haven't yet seen how I can contribute.
But we have. You're what we need. A trained sociologist with a radically realistic outlook. Also, you can write.
You don't mean you want me to write up all this?
No. We want you to write it down. To camouflage it. Once it gets going, we shan't have to worry. But in the meantime, it does make a difference how things are put. For instance, if it were even whispered that the NICE wanted powers to experiment on criminals, you'd have all the old women of both sexes, mind, up in arms and yapping about humanity. Call it re-education of the maladjusted, and you have them all slobbering with delight that the brutal era of retributive punishment has at last come to an end.
Yes.
Odd thing it is. The word experiment is unpopular, but not the word experimental. You mustn't experiment on children, but offer the dear little kiddies free education in an experimental school attached to the NICE, it's all correct.
Look out!
Don't worry, Studdock. You need never take a crossroad line that seriously. But it's impossible to say at this stage, you know, how your job might develop.
Jane's little train jerks and rattles along, past Bragton Wood and Bragton Camp, along the edge of Brawl Park, and on to Duke's Eton, Woolham, Cure Hardy, and Fourstones. The autumn sunlight grows warm on the window. Passengers get in and out at every stop. Apple-faced men and women with imitation fruit on their hats, and schoolboys. And so to St. Anne's, where the train settles back when it stops with a little jerk and something like a sigh.
St. Anne's! St. Anne's!
There is still a climb to be done on foot, for St. Anne's is perched on a hilltop, the highest ground in all that region. She passes a church, turns left at the Saxon cross, the timbered Midland plain spreading as far as she can see and blue in the distance. Presently, she comes to a high wall that seems to run for a great way. There is a door in it, and beside the door, an old iron bell pull.
Allow me to introduce you. Mark Studdock. John Wither, Deputy Director of the NICE.
It gives me great pleasure, very great pleasure, Mr. Studdock, to welcome you to Bilbury. I do hope you had an agreeable journey.
Yes, sir. Very. Thank you.
Your flight was not delayed.
No, I didn't fly, sir.
And how was London when you left it?
Not London, sir. I came from Edgestone. I was wondering if you would enlighten me, sir. I'm not entirely clear in what capacity I might be able to assist the Institute.
I assure you, Mr. Studdock, that you needn't anticipate the slightest difficulty on that point. There was never any idea of circumscribing your activities and your general influence on policy, much less the terms of reference under which you would be collaborating with us.
I just feel I should like some idea of what I shall be doing if I come to you.
Well, now, when you speak of coming to us, Lord Feverston, I feel sure you will fully agree with me that nothing was further from the mind of the committee than to dictate in any way, or even to advise, where where your friend should live.
Quite. Really, sir, I wasn't thinking about that at all. It is the exact nature of the work that I wanted to get clear.
My dear young man, you need not have the slightest uneasiness in that direction. You are among friends here, Mr. Studdock. I should be the last person to advise you to connect yourself with any organization where you ran the risk of being exposed to disagreeable personal contact.
You are very kind. The only thing I should like to get clear is the scope of the appointment.
Well, I am very glad that you have raised that issue in a quite informal way. We do not really think among ourselves of strictly demarcated functions. Everyone in the Institute feels that his own work is not so much a departmental contribution to an end already defined as a moment or grade in the progressive self-definition of an organic whole.
I do think that is so important. The elasticity of your organization is one of the things that attracts me.
Yes? Does Miss Ironwood live here? Yes. I want to see her, please. Have you an appointment? Well, not exactly. I was directed here by Dr. Dimble, who knows Miss Ironwood.
Oh, if you're from Dr. Dimble, that's another matter. Come in.
Goodbye, sir. Thank you.
Goodbye, Mr. And you, Lord Feverson.
Goodbye, Mr. Wither.
Well, when shall I know my fate? Have I got the job?
Hello, Guy. Can you spare a second?
And Mark is left alone in the corridors of Belbury, wondering what to do, attempting to look natural, and trying not to catch the eyes of strangers. At length, he finds the dining room and goes in to lunch. Sits at the long table among the strangers.
It makes no difference which way they set it.
Now, I've no objection to the IJP people taking over the whole thing if that's what the DD wants, but what I object to is one man.
It's a relief when people begin getting up from table. He follows the general move to a room where coffee is being served, and there, to his delight, he spots one of his Bracton colleagues, William Hingist.
Ah, this is an unexpected pleasure, Hingist.
Yeah. Huh? Oh, it's you, Stannigans. Didn't know they'd secured your services here.
I was sorry not to see you at the college meeting yesterday.
What's that? What were they talking about?
About the sale of Bragdon Wood.
All nonsense.
I hope you will agree with the decision we came to.
It made no difference what decision you came to.
So?
The NICE would have had the wood in any case. They had powers to compel a sale.
What an extraordinary thing. I was given to understand they were going to Cambridge if we didn't sell.
There's nothing extraordinary in the fellows of Bracton talking all afternoon about an unreal issue. And there's nothing extraordinary in the fact that the NICE should wish to hand over to Bracton the odium of turning the heart of England into a cross between an abortive American hotel and a glorified gasworks. The only real puzzle is why the NICE wants that bit of land.
Well, I suppose we shall find out as things go on.
Well, you may. I shan't. I've had enough of it. I'm leaving tonight. I don't know what you were doing at Bracton, but if it was any good, I'd advise you to go back and stick to it.
Really? Why do you say that?
Doesn't matter for an old fellow like me, but they could play the devil with you. What's your subject?
Sociology.
Oh.
Ats and ands. The young woman leads Jane along a brick path beside a wall on which fruit trees grow, past a greenhouse, a barn, a stable, a pigsty, then a vegetable garden, then rose bushes, stiff and prickly in their winter garb. Odd thoughts of gardens spring to Jane's mind.
The garden in Peter Rabbit.
In The Romance of the Rose.
The garden in Alice.
They emerge from plantations of rhododendron and laurel and find themselves at a small door by a water butt in the long wall of a large house.
Are you Mr. Studdock?
Yes.
Oh, we've been expecting you.
Is Miss Ironwood in?
Yes.
My name's Camilla. Camilla Denniston. Hello. One moment.
Yes?
She's come.
And Jane goes in to stand before Miss Ironwood, who sits...
A big woman.
Unsmiling.
Dressed all in black.
With her hands folded on her knees. Just as Jane had seen her in her dream last night.
Sit down, young lady. Does your husband know you have come here?
No.
Your age, if you please.
23.
Right. What have you to tell me?
I've been having bad dreams and feeling depressed lately.
What were the dreams?
And as Jane speaks of Alcassan in his cell, the man with the pince-nez, of the prisoner's terror, the horrible unscrewing of his head, of the old man with the red beard, the way he was dug up, she becomes fascinated by Miss Ironwood's hands. Immensely strong hands, they seem, wrapping themselves around the pencil she holds. Jane sees the fingers tighten, the knuckles grow white, the veins stand out on the backs of the hands, until at last, under the influence of some stifled emotion, they snap the pencil in two. but Miss Ironwood's wide grey eyes still look at her with no change of expression.
Is there, do you think, anything very seriously wrong with me?
There is nothing wrong with you.
Oh, you mean it will go away?
I have no means of telling. I should say probably not.
Then can't anything be done about it? They were horrible dreams, horribly vivid, not like dreams at all.
I can quite understand that.
But it's surely not natural to have dreams like that.
I will begin by saying this. You are a more important person than you imagine. What was your maiden name?
Tudor.
Did you ever read a little book written by an ancestor of yours about the Battle of Worcester?
No, but I know of it.
Your ancestor gave a full, and on the whole, correct account of the battle, which he says he completed on the same day on which it was fought. But he was not at it. He was in York at the time. If he was speaking the truth, and we believe that he was, he dreamed it. Vision, the power of dreaming realities, is sometimes hereditary.
Can it be proved? We only have his word for it.
We have your dreams. My opinion is that you have seen real things in your dreams. You have seen Aucassin as he really sat in his condemned cell, and you have seen a visitor whom he really had.
Oh, this is ridiculous. It was all impossible. He screwed off his head, I tell you. And they dug up the horrible old man. They made him come to life.
In my opinion, there are realities behind even those episodes.
I'm afraid I don't believe in that sort of thing.
Your upbringing makes it natural that you should not.
Can you then do nothing for me?
I can tell you the truth. I have tried to do so.
I mean, can you not stop it, cure it?
Vision is not a disease.
But I don't want it. I must stop it. I hate this sort of thing. Can't you recommend anyone?
If you go to an ordinary psychotherapist, he would proceed on the assumption that the dreams reflect your own subconscious. He would try to treat you. I do not know what would be the results of treatment based on that assumption. I'm afraid they might be very serious, and it would certainly not remove the dream.
This is unbearable. Why should I be selected for this horrible thing?
The answer to that is known only to authorities much higher than myself.
Perhaps I'd better be going. But how can you know all this?
We know your dreams to be partly true because they fit in with information we already possess. It was because he saw their importance that Dr. Dimble sent you to us.
Do you mean to say he sent me here not to be cured, but to give information?
Exactly.
I wish I had known that a little earlier. I'm afraid there has been a misunderstanding. I had imagined Dr. Dimble was trying to help me.
He was, but he was trying to do something more important at the same time.
How exactly was I to be helped by this sort of thing?
Young lady, you do not at all realize the seriousness of this matter. The things you have seen concern something compared with which the happiness, or even the life, of you and me is of no importance. I must beg you to face the situation. You cannot get rid of your gift. You can try to suppress it, but you will fail, and you will be very badly frightened. On the other hand, you can put it at our disposal. If you do so, you will be much less frightened in the long run, and you will be helping to save the human race from a very great disaster. Or thirdly, you may tell someone else about it. If you do that, you will almost certainly fall into the hands of other people who are at least as anxious as we to make use of your faculty and who will care no more about your life and happiness than about those of a fly. I would advise you, even for your own sake, to join our side.
You keep talking of we and us. Are you some kind of company?
Yes, you may call it a company.
I must go home now. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't want to have anything to do with it.
At the same moment that Jane is stalking angrily from Miss Ironwood's office, Mark, still hovering uncertainly in an anteroom at Belbury, is approached by a huge hill of a man, fat to the degree that is comic on the stage, yet decidedly unfunny in real life.
Mr. Stoddock?
Yes?
My name is Phil Strato. I am very glad you have come to join us.
To tell you the truth, I'm not entirely sure that I have. I was brought here by Lord Feverston, but I don't know why. I have a strong objection to being put in a forced position.
Listen, my friend.
The NICE is serious. The future of the human race depends on our work, our real work. You comprehend?
As long as I'm given something to do that is worth doing.
No, the work is more important than you understand. You will see. Feverson and such as him, of no consequence. As long as you have the goodwill of the deputy director, you snap your fingers at them. Ah, there is one other. Do not have the fairy for your enemy.
The fairy?
Yes. Her they call the fairy. Oh, my God. A terrible Inglesacci. She is the head of our police. Of course, she come. I will present you. Miss Hardcastle, permit that I present to you Mr. Stoddock.
Hello, Sonny.
And a big woman in a black short-skirted uniform grasps Mark's hand in the grip of a stoker.
Sit down. We must have a chat.
A smudge of lipstick, laid on with violent inattention to the shape of her mouth, is her only concession to fashion. And she rolls and chews a long black cheroot between her teeth. She sits in a chair close to Mark, flings her leg over one of the arms, and fixes him with a gaze of cold intimacy.
I'm glad I've met you, Sonny.
And by way of getting to know Mark, she regales him with a series of smoking room stories, of police reminiscences. Among other things, states her belief that
30% of our murder trials end with a hanging of an innocent man.
Good Lord.
I haven't always been a policewoman, Stoddard. I've been imprisoned myself. I know from both sides what a police force can and cannot do. And believe me, Sonny, there are very few things it can't. Especially now.
Really?
We're taking responsibility for most aspects of the Institute's day-to-day administration. Everything from vaccination to unnatural vice comes under us. As for crime, we've already popularized in the press the idea that the NICE should be allowed to experiment, to discover how far humane remedial treatment could be substituted for the old notion of retributive or vindictive punishment.
Well, that's very sensible.
You've got to get the ordinary man into the state in which he says sadism automatically when he hears the word punishment.
I don't quite follow.
You will. What has hampered every police force to date is this idea of deserved punishment. If you have punishment to fit the crime, you can do so much to the criminal and no more. But remedial treatment has no limit. It goes on till it's effected a cure, and we decide when that is. And if cure is desirable and humane, how much more prevention? Soon, anyone who has ever been in the hands of the police at all will come under the control of the NICE. In the end, every citizen. And that's where you and I come in, Sonny. There's no distinction in the long run between police work and sociology. You and I have got to work hand in hand.
But you know, I'm not entirely sure I've been given a job here yet.
Oh, you're in all right, Sonny. And don't be too particular about what you've got to do. Wither doesn't like people who try to pin him down. There's no good saying you've come here to do this and you won't do that. Game's too fast for that sort of thing.
Now, listen, mate, I'll make it easy for you, all right? You can stay in the house till 8 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Look, really?
This is just too dreadful.
Must be some mistake. No. The only mistake is you're still here.
But don't you realize this is our house?
No, it's not, lady. This house belongs to Braxton College. They've made it over to the NICE, and the NICE needs the site.
Oh, Cecil, no. That's the beach tree.
Look, I can't believe the college bursar has given permission for this without informing us.
It's nothing to do with me. I'm acting on instructions, and my instructions are to get on and get the whole site flattened. But like I say, I'm not going to rush you. Get out by 8 and I'll turn a blind eye if you're here overnight. Fair enough, huh? It'll take us a while to drop them trees anyway.
Oh, Cecil!
Well, my dear, this is something it's impossible to fight. Look, Jane Staddock will put you up for the night, I'm sure. I'll stay in my rooms in college.
Cecil, they're utterly conscienceless.
Oh, yes.
Oh, have they finally roped you into it?
I rather believe they have, Hingis, yes.
Because if you thought the better of it, I'm about to motor back to Brecton. I could offer you a lift.
You haven't told me why you were leaving us yourself.
Oh, well, it all depends on what a man likes. If you enjoyed the society of that Italian eunuch,
and the mad parson and that hard castle girl.
I suppose it's hardly to be judged on purely social grounds.
I came here because I thought it had something to do with science. Now that I find it's a political conspiracy, I shall go home.
I can quite understand that it doesn't fit in with your work as it does with sciences like sociology.
There are no sciences like sociology. And if I found chemistry beginning to fit in with the secret police run by a middle-aged virago who doesn't wear corsets, and a scheme for taking away his farm and his shop and his children from every Englishman, I'd let chemistry go to the devil and take up gardening again.
Bill? Is it true you're going off by car shortly?
Yes, Miss Hardcastle, it is.
I was wondering if you could give me a lift.
I should be happy to do so if we are going in the same direction.
Where are you going?
I'm going to Edgestone.
Will you be passing Brenstock?
No. I leave the bypass at the crossroads just beyond Lord Hollywood's front gate and go down what they used to call Potter's Lane.
No, damn, no good to me. May as well wait till the morning.
Right. I'm away.
I'll walk with you to your car.
Take my advice, Studdock, or at least think it over. I don't believe in sociology myself, but you've got quite a decent career ahead of you if you stay at Brecton. You'll do no good by getting mixed up with the NICE. And by God, you'll do nobody else any good either. Frost in the air. Feel it?
I suppose there are two views about anything.
There are a dozen views about everything until you know the answer. Then there's never more than one. That's no affair of mine. Good night.
Good night, Angus.
And as Mark watches Hengist go, he's slightly startled to find at his elbow a thin man dressed in threadbare black with a frayed clerical collar.
Mr. Studdock.
Yes.
I am the Reverend Strake.
And by those few unremarkable words, Mark knows that here is the mad parson Hengist spoke of.
I do believe it.
Despite the frost, Strake leads Mark by the arm out into the garden.
Let me shut the window. Oh, it's almost as if we'd lost the war. Oh. The whole town is in uproar. There's demolition and destruction everywhere you look. It's utterly frightening. Oh. When one sees this wholesale callous wreckage going on, it makes one almost glad one doesn't have children. Have you never wanted children, Jane, dear?
Oh, well, I don't say I'll never have them, but at the moment I feel I've already given up enough of myself just getting married. I've got my own life to live.
Well, it's so kind of you to put me up.
Oh, you must stay here as long as you like, Mrs. Dimble. Mark will just have to sleep in college.
I feel at the moment that no fellow of Bracton ought to be allowed to sleep anywhere. Mm.
Until this night, for about 300 years, the common room at Bracton has been one of the quiet places of England. As the fellows sit over their wine and dessert, candlelight reflects in the dark Jacobean panelling, the silver of many different periods. But on this night, there come such noises as have never been heard here before.
I must say, dear, it's a little bit of a surprise just how wholesale this construction work out there is.
Well, you're not going to get rid of a ward without a little bit of disruption, can you?
They seem to be right outside the window.
Yes, yes, they do, don't they?
What the devil are your friends outside doing?
Can't they work without shouting?
I'm afraid we have to put up with a certain amount of inconvenience.
Right. This isn't inconvenience, this is torture.
It's getting worse every minute. Oh, what is that? They're murdering somebody.
I couldn't see what's happening. Someone's ringing up the police. I shouldn't go out there if I were you. It sounds as if the police or something's there already.
Do not imagine that our program will be carried out without violence, Mr. Studdock. There will be resistance, and we will face it with firmness. It is no part of our witness to preserve that organization of ordered sin which is called society.
That, Reverend Strake, is where your point of view and mine are incompatible. The preservation of society is precisely the end I have in view. The problem's quite different for you, because you look forward to something better than human society in some other world.
With every drop of my blood, I repudiate that damnable doctrine. The kingdom of God is to be realized here, in this world. And it will be. At the name of Jesus, every knee shall bow.
Well, I'm afraid I'm not terribly up on theology.
Theology? It's not theology I'm talking about, young man, but the Lord Jesus. I know that he's coming in power. So where we see power, we see the sign of his coming. I shall be used. We will all be used. There is no turning back once you have set your hand to the plow. No one goes out of the NICE.
Now, Potter's Lane.
Jane, dear, are you dreaming?
Hello? What's this?
What?
I saw your lantern. What's going on?
Police, sir.
Oh, yeah? What's up?
Would you mind just getting out of the car, sir, a moment?
What for?
We need to check your identity, sir.
Mine? Why?
If you wouldn't mind, sir, it won't take a moment.
There seems a lot of fuss. All right. Let's up.
In episode one of That Hideous Strength by C.S. Lewis, Jane was played by Catherine Hurlburt, Mark by Andrew Wincott, Feverstone by Steve Hodson, and C.S. Lewis by Garrard Green. Curry was Philip Anthony, Busby, Edwin Richfield, Dr. Dimble, Graham Colclough, Mrs. Dimble, Tina Gray, Miss Ironwood, Daphne Rogers, and Camilla, Sean Lloyd Owen. Wither was played by Geoffrey Banks, Hinguist and Philostrato by Roger Hume. Miss Hardcastle by Judy Bridgeland, The Workman by Terry Malloy, and Strake by Robin Kyle. The music was composed and played by Vic Gammon. That Hideous Strength was dramatised by Stephen Malatrat and directed at Pebble Mill by Nigel Bryant.